Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, never heard of it before a few weeks ago, set off something of a firestorm recently with its controversial recommendations about when women should start getting regular mammograms. The task force has since modified its recommendations, and the National Comprehensive Cancer Network said it continues to recommend annual clinical breast examinations and mammograms for women 40 years and older at normal risk. But now I'm really confused. So we asked two OSU gynecologic cancer experts from the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center to join us today to go over the basics. Give us a refresher course on what our options are when it comes to cancer screening for women. Joining us today, Dr. William Farr. He's Division Director of Surgical Oncology and Director of Medical Affairs at the OSU Comprehensive Cancer Center. He specializes in breast cancer surgery and research. Welcome, Dr. Farr.
Welcome. Thank you.
And Dr. Eric Eisenhower. Dr. Eisenhower is a physician surgeon in the Division of Gynecologic Oncology at the OSU Comprehensive Cancer Center. His clinical and research interests include minimally invasive surgery, treatment of recurrent disease, and improving therapy and outcomes for women with hereditary and sporadic ovarian cancer. Thanks for being here today, Dr. Eisenhower.
Thank you.
We've been living with the same basic rules for many years, as long as I've been around and been conscious. Pap tests every year, mammograms every year after turning 40. And now we're getting mixed messages no matter what. And some folks aren't taking it very well. And I was wondering if you're hearing a lot from your patients and if there's a lot of chatter in your community. Dr.
Well,
Farr?
There is a lot of chatter in the breast community, especially a few weeks ago. I think it was like on November 16th when the guidelines or at least the recommendations from the U.S. Preventive Task Force came out that was suggesting that women did not need to start getting mammograms till age 50, and then you only needed one every 2 years. And obviously that got everyone's attention.
When were you getting a lot of calls from people, patients, that sort of thing, or friends?
All of the above. Patients specifically. I have two rather large breast clinics every week, and just so happened that I had a breast clinic on the Tuesday that this was announced. And so about everyone that had come in was asking, what does this mean and what should we do and et cetera, et cetera. And obviously our nurse practitioners who field a lot of our phone calls got a tremendous amount of phone calls in the ensuing week.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How about you, Dr. Eisenhower? Same sort of thing, because some recommendations came out about Pap tests soon after.
So certainly we've been getting lots of questions about how this influences their certainly their cervical cancer screening, but also how it also involves their annual gynecologic exams and whether the two are the same or separate.
What do you tell them?
The annual gynecologic exam really involves a lot more than just a Pap test, and I think that the takeaway from all of this is that these annual gynecologic exams are still very important, and the altered interval of the Pap screening is really going to be determined by the gynecologist at an appropriate interval, but the annual exam is still important.
Is change as hard for the medical community as it seems like it is for the medical consumer community? Just listening to the outrage, and the confusion too. These can't be concepts necessarily that you haven't thought about and discussed and bantered about over the years.
Well, you're exactly right. Breast cancer screening, obviously, we've been doing for basically over 20 years now since mammography really became the state of the art in regards to picking up early breast cancers. But we all know in the medical community that mammograms aren't perfect. Still, mammograms by themselves miss about 20% of cancers. So do we need to find a better tool? Do we need to make different recommendations? For right now, I think we have to follow the guidelines that we have. But I do think the task force, brought it to light that we do need to continue to look for a better means of screening than mammogram, because we know mammogram's not perfect.
If you're just joining All Sides with Ann Fisher, my guests right now are Dr. Eric Eisenhower and Dr. William Farr. They are both with the at the OHSU Comprehensive Cancer Center. There's a lot longer title to all of that. You can go to the website at WOSU.org/allsides and get all the scoop on that. Dr. Eisenhower, isn't all the discussion good, though? Because a lot of women, after so many years of following the same rules or not following them, become, you know, you get kind of passive about it. And you just sort of like sheep, you know, you just kind of, you know, mosey to your gynecological exam every year and do whatever they tell you to do. Is it good to question?
I think it's certainly good to question, especially when it comes to cervical cancer screening, which over the course of the last 50 years has been an extremely effective cancer screening method with a more than 70% reduction in the number of invasive cervical cancer cases that we're seeing each year. As a result of that screening, it's hard to change a model that's been effective. And I think that the like any screening test that's been available for a while, we get more information about not only the benefits but the consequences of screening as we have a longer period of time to evaluate those outcomes. And these new recommendations are really based on those outcomes.
In other countries, they don't screen as much. In other, you know, Western countries, the United Kingdom, UK, they actually follow, I think, the World Health Organization recommendation, which is very close to what the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force had said. And regardless of whether that's good or bad or right or wrong, some folks say that we're sort of addicted to testing in this country, that we think we put a lot more faith in it and that maybe we should, just generally. We like to be tested often and thoroughly.
Well, I think there's some truth to that. But on the other hand, I think we need to see and look at the results of the testing. Just like Dr. Eisenhower said, we've made a huge reduction in the number of invasive cervical cancers. Mm-hmm. And we have made a significant impact on breast mortality. With screening starting at age 40, we've increased breast mortality in this country over the last 10 years by 15% to 20%. And that's significant. There's a lot of debate that, well, it increases the number of biopsies and it increases the number of this and that. Well, so be it. If we decrease the mortality of the most common cancer in this country by 15% to 20%, I think we've accomplished something. Is it perfect? No. And I think that's why, as you said, I think we need to still discuss it and look at it. And if something needs to be changed, then we need to change it. But right now, we don't have any data that tells us that we're doing that much more harm than what we've seen the benefit to be.
Thank good. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or send us an email at allsides@wosu.org. We'll get to the calls as soon as possible. I wanted to ask you, as far as starting the conversation, sometimes it's difficult for people to do that with their doctors. Now, you just kind of go and you take the tests. I think women sometimes forget we have options. There's different kinds of tests. You don't always have to do the same thing, and there's different kinds of treatments. You don't have to have a biopsy if you don't want to have a biopsy. For instance, how do you handle those conversations, Dr. Farr?
Well, I think to be honest with you, there's not a lot of discussion that goes on these days about getting a yearly mammogram. Most women are very accepting of that. I'll tell you, a lot of women, especially with a family history, want to know, can I get one earlier or should my daughter get one? And when should my daughter get one? And so we don't see a lot of backing off of getting mammograms because I think the word is out that they have been very successful. And the same thing on biopsies. I think the medical community in general has at least in breast cancer and breast management, really only does biopsies when it's really definitely necessary. There are a lot of women that we see that get a mammogram or a physical exam and, let's check it again in 6 months and if nothing changes, we'll leave it alone. So I don't really get a lot of people backing away from a recommendation.
You said earlier that mammogram, the technology became sort of state of the art about 20 years ago. So when did it reach that point where it became as effective as it is?
Well, I think it's continuing to be more effective.
Okay.
You know, in fact, the data that the U.S. Preventive Task Force looked at was randomized controlled trials that were done back in the 80s and 90s. And this was before we had digital mammography and MRI and different techniques that we use now. So I'm not sure if relooking at old data and coming up with same conclusions is the right way to do it. I think almost most of the major institutions now have digital mammography, which gives the clarity of the film, which improves the clarity of field tremendously, and we're able to pick up much, much smaller cancers. And coordinating that with the use of MRI, especially in women who are at high risk, have made a major impact from the film screen mammography that we were using back in the 80s and 90s. But even though that's sort of old technology now, it was still much better than anything else that we had at the time.
Let's talk about those normal versus high risks. What's a normal risk? How do you define that? Is it different depending on what the disease is, or is there generalized definitions for that, Dr. Eisenhower?
It depends very much on the disease that you're talking about. Certain cancers are more prevalent in populations of patients with certain risk factors. Certainly, in the case of cervical cancer, the predominant cause of cervical cancer is an infection, and so things that would predispose women to either develop that infection, meaning have risk factors for acquiring the infection, or immunologic problems which prevent them from clearing the infection, certainly put certain groups of women at higher risk.
Okay. And then what about breast cancer? What's a normal – what do we mean by normal risk?
Well, that's an interesting question because there really isn't a normal risk in this country. When you have a disease that one out of eight women is going to get in their lifetime, everyone's at risk. So there really isn't a normal risk for breast cancer. What we have been able to do is identify people who are at a very high risk, and those are people who mainly have a first-degree relative with breast cancer, have a premenopausal breast cancer, have bilateral breast cancer. Those women are at high risk of having a genetically predisposed cancer, and therefore their family members are predisposed to possibly getting that cancer. And now we have ways through randomized clinical trials of identifying drugs such as tamoxifen and Evista that we can use on that high-risk patient population. So I think we don't have a normal risk in breast cancer. Everyone's at risk, but we have been able to identify a high-risk group of women who will benefit from taking some pills.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. My guests, Dr. Eric Eisenhower, Dr. William Farr, they are both at the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center. They're here to talk about breast cancer, cervical cancer, and answer your questions and respond to your comments. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you have either, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Good morning, and thanks for joining us for All Sides. At 1 o'clock this afternoon, On Point will be here. It's crunch time for healthcare reform. Howard Dean and more on why the progressives' push for a public option fell apart, and what it all means for Obama's stab at healthcare history. That discussion at 1 o'clock on Point, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Be sure to catch ArtZine, Columbus's monthly art show, anytime online at wosu.org/artzine. You can check out this month's show with the past, present, and future of the Thurber House as it celebrates its 25th anniversary. ArtZine gives you a firsthand look at the arts in action in Columbus at wosu.org/artzine. 26 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20. Some sunshine today and a high of 38. A few clouds tonight and a low of 25. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest today, Dr. Eric Eisenhower and Dr. William Farr. They are both experts on cancer at the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Decided to have this show because there's been so much discussion and chat and general concern since the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force amended its recommendations about women should start getting regular mammograms. The task force has since modified its amendment. and the National Comprehensive Cancer Network says it's continuing to recommend annual clinical breast examinations and mammograms for women 40 years and older at normal risk. And we've just talked with Dr. Farr about that. And there really is no such thing as normal risk. There is, however, high risk categories. And that's something you need to talk with your doctor about. Dr. Eisenhower, we were just talking about that. How do you know? Is it something that your doctor sees on your chart and they come to you and talk to you about it? Or is it something you should be going to your doctor to talk about when you feel like you're high risk? Well, let's take cervical cancer, for instance. You said it's an infection. Is that something you seek out advice on?
Yeah, I think an important part of both initial patient visits and follow-up patient visits is assessing, in this case, risk factors that patients have for cervical cancer. So in this case, it involves things that would predispose them to a HPV infection, like a new partner or other associated risks, as well as revisiting those same issues at subsequent visits. And so it's difficult oftentimes to assume – so many patients come with questions, but it's difficult to assume that that all the patients that come to see me are going to know the questions ahead of time and to put themselves into the risk category. We spend a good portion of time trying to assess those risks for them and help them interpret what those risks are.
Okay, 614-292-8513. George, you've been on the phone for a while, and I appreciate that you waited. What can we do for you?
Well, doctors, thank you very much for this very important show. My wife, unfortunately, is a frequent flyer at the James. She was diagnosed with a BRCA1 gene mutation in 1999, underwent a full hysterectomy in 2000, and was diagnosed with primary peritoneal cancer in 2004 and has been in treatment since 2004 for what is essentially ovarian cancer. My concern is it seems like in this country we always try and come up with a high-tech solution, and we sometimes miss some easier ways or better ways of controlling disease. And my question is, doctors, what is the rate of breast cancer today as compared to generations past? I mean, I understand that screening is important, and I wouldn't belittle that, but it doesn't seem like much is being done on lifestyle and that sort of research to determine what are we doing today compared to generations past, and is there anything that we're doing today that exacerbates the rate of breast cancer and ovarian cancer?
Dr. Farr?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and it is something that we are spending a tremendous amount of research on, is to looking at ways that we can prevent breast cancer. One of the best examples is probably the breast cancer prevention trial, which was followed by the STAR trial, which looked at high-risk women and the taking a pill called tamoxifen in the first breast cancer prevention trial, and in the second trial looked at taking tamoxifen versus Evista. And both of those trials showed that if you fell into this high-risk group, that you could decrease your risk of breast cancer by as much as 50%, which was really a landmark study with showing basically the first time that a drug could prevent a cancer. We have looked at many issues, from alcohol to cigarettes to obesity, to many issues, trying to find out is there things we can do to change our lifestyles that would help prevent breast cancer. We participated in what was called the WINS trial, the Women's Interventional Nutrition Study, which was a study that lasted about 8 years looking at women who had breast cancer and the amount of fat in their diet. And this study clearly showed that if you decreased your fat intake to 15%, which excludes almost every food that you can imagine, you did decrease your risk of getting recurrent breast cancer, which clearly showed that possibly that a low-fat diet have an impact at least on recurrent cancer from this study. So we continue to look at the variables that, you were mentioning, try to find some way that that we can impact the numbers of breast cancer. Breast cancer in this country goes up about 2 to 3% a year in regards to incidence, but the population also goes up a little bit more than that. So the incidence really is increasing. The interesting number is over the last 8 years, the mortality of breast cancer continues to go down. And even though we haven't affected the incidence that much, we have made an impact on mortality.
And one other question, if I may. Mm-hmm. The recommendation to decrease the number of mammograms for the population at large is not something that I don't think was made in a vacuum. I mean, it's not as though there are no risks to repeated exposures to mammograms and to the general population. I mean, doctors, you can speak to this better, but for example, we don't want to expose the whole population at large to CA-125 exams. Is it really necessary? And I think that's where that recommendation was coming from, is that for the benefit at the population at large, is the risk worth it to the population at large? And is that not where the decision came from?
Well, if I think I understand your question, if we could identify who was at high risk of developing breast cancer, maybe those are the ones that would need a mammogram. And the ones that don't have that risk maybe do not need a mammogram. The problem is there is no way at this point in time to identify or select out those patients. As you may or may not know, only about 15% of women have a high risk of breast cancer that get breast cancer. The other 85% do not have a high risk of breast cancer. So those are the ones that we're targeting with the annual mammograms. And, you know, decreasing the mortality by 15 to 20% of a disease by getting a screening mammogram is not insignificant.
That's true. Absolutely true. And then the one other thing is that after being in the medical system as many years as my wife and I have been, it's what's really hard for the layperson to reconcile is that the recommendations are made on averages, but the application of medicine takes place with individuals. And it's oftentimes, you know, it's hard to reconcile recommendations that are made for a population at whole versus your specific situation in what you need to do in your treatment schedules and so on and so forth. And I think that's where the art of the doctor comes in. And from what I've seen, the James does a remarkable job.
Thanks for your call, George. Are you there? We can't hear you. Okay. I mean, you know, unfortunately, George is experienced at this. So many of us never confront a lot of the struggles that George and his wife have confronted. And so you're always new. It's always a new, something new and unknown. And you hope you only get it once or never at all. And if you're only getting cancer once in your life, you're a neophyte at it. You don't even know. It was, we talked about earlier, you don't know what questions to ask. You don't know what to do. How do you treat people differently or talk to them differently when they're new to it than they are when they've been through it before?
Certainly the sort of questions that patients have and the sort of concerns that are top of mind vary significantly, whether or not they've this is a new information for them or whether it's a problem that they've been facing for a while. And I think the tenor of the of the conversation and the specificity of the questions is much different if this is a problem that they've had for a while.
Okay, if you'd like to email us, you're welcome. allsides@wosu.org. We have an email now from a listener. They write, "To me, the biggest surprise was how many false positives were reported. I heard on another NPR program that the false positive rate in Europe was significantly lower than in the United States. They attributed this to stricter teaching standards and to requiring a higher number of hours before qualifying for certification as a radiologist. Can your guests discuss this finding and offer any solutions?" So that's another aspect of it, is how people are trained to read the screens in the first place. Dr. Farr?
Well, I think that's part of it. But there's another side to this that you've got to realize, that mammography is the highest litigation we have in medicine. I hate to bring that up, but it's a reality. And I think radiologists really are trained to err on the safe side, mainly for the patient. And if they see something, then they need to follow up on it. I think we need to clarify what's meant by false positive. A false positive just means that there's an abnormality on the mammogram that requires further films, possibly an ultrasound, and possibly a biopsy. What came out of the U.S. Preventive Task Force was that there are 99 false positives in this country for every 1,000 women, which really is not that extreme.
Some of the risks of mammogram that never occurred to me before all of this, the false positive, which may lead you to have biopsies or other something more extreme that you wouldn't need, anxiety, the psychological impact of it, accumulated radiation exposure as well. And I'm wondering, let's talk about that accumulated radiation exposure. What are we talking about there? How serious is that?
When we started doing mammograms back in the late 70s and early 80s, mammograms were being done on a regular X-ray machine. And in that scenario, there was a significant risk because the radiation effect was quite high. Once we started using mammogram machines that were dedicated just for mammography, the radiation is really minimal. In fact, one of our radiologists, Dr. Olson, back in the late 80s, did a study and calculated that you got just as much radiation driving in your car from Columbus to Cleveland as you did from getting the mammogram, or smoking 3 cigarettes, or riding in an airplane for 30 minutes. So I think he was just trying to make the point that the radiation exposure is really very minimal. And we've been doing X-rays, mammograms for over 30 years, and we've not really seen an increased incidence of any problems from radiation.
And if it's false negative, what about that issue of false negative? That's a chance with almost anything, isn't it? Or is it particularly a problem with breast cancer?
Well, in breast cancer, the false negative rate is, as I said, for a mammogram is about 20%.
Right.
And that's why you need to incorporate a clinical breast exam with getting a mammogram. And the two together still miss about 5 to 10% of breast cancers. So the false negative rate is significant. MRI may be something that we're using more of down the road if we can figure out how to decrease the cost. But if you combine MRI with clinical breast exam mammography, you're only going to miss about 5 to 8% of cancers.
What about that anxiety issue? Is the psychological effects, is it that important? Is it create that many problems that would come up on a risk?
Well, it is. There's nothing worse than a lady coming in to get a mammogram and then going home and getting a letter 2 days later that you need to come back to get some films that you can't get for another week. We have tried to minimize that anxiety at our breast center by trying to do everything the same day. So a woman gets a mammogram, she sees her doctor, she gets her follow-up films if she needs it, and that decreases that anxiety. But there's no question that the anxiety of waiting to get an answer on what's going on with your mammogram is significant.
And but does it, I can understand the anxiety, been there and done that, but I'm wondering just overall, the overall effect of that, is it that damaging or is it just a drag?
No,
you just don't want to make someone go through that.
It's not damaging. You just don't want, you don't want to have someone go through that anxiety.
Okay. Do mammograms kind of make us lazy? If you can just get a mammogram every year, you don't really – is that one of the reasons why women aren't very good at the self-breast examinations and that kind of thing?
Well, I think one of the main reasons women aren't good at self-breast exam is because people keep telling them you don't need to do it. If you look at the U.S. Preventive Task Force, they say don't do self-breast exams. We went through this debate about 7 or 8 years ago, and it's the bottom line is, yes, if you take 1,000 women that do self-breast exams, it's probably going to cause more biopsies than you find cancers. But if you take out the one lady who found a 5-millimeter cancer in her breast by self-breast exam that didn't show up on mammogram, then you probably saved that lady's life by doing a self-breast exam. And the other side of the coin, self-breast exams really don't cost that much.
Yeah, they say you could just do them right in the shower. You give you those things to hang over the shower, the spout, and it's all very, very easy. But people don't do it. They don't want to do the easy thing. And we talked about preventive things, lifestyle choices and that kind of thing that you could make that people tend not to make. So it's all out there. If you have a question for Dr. Farr or Dr. Eisenhower, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We're talking about all the issues surrounding breast cancer, mammograms, that kind of thing, and also cervical cancer and what you can do about it and what you ought to know when you go to see your doctor. We're going to take a quick break right now. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I listen to NPR every day. It gives us insight into why people do what they do and have a passion for it. We hear from people in their words, and it's not the reporters telling us what this and that person said, whether it's about the economy in the United States or the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm Bethany Donnell, and WOSU is my source for in-depth reporting in a soundbite age.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides will be here, and we'll hear about human rights and legal issues affecting immigrants in the United States, including the immigration detention system. That discussion begins in 20 minutes. It starts at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 28 degrees in downtown Columbus on our way to a high of 38 degrees with a few clouds and some sunshine today. A few clouds tonight and a low of 25. Gray skies for Friday and a high of 43. And looking ahead to Saturday, there is a slight chance of snow and a high of 34 degrees.
Support for WOSU comes from Integrate, helping to improve business performance through brand design and marketing communications for more than 20 years. On the web at integrateinc.com or at 614-421-0004.
All Sides continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest today, Dr. Eric Eisenhower, Dr. William Farr. Dr. Farr is Division Director of Surgical Oncology and Director of Medical Affairs at the OSU Comprehensive Cancer Center. He specializes in breast cancer surgery and research. And also Dr. Eisenhower, he's a physician surgeon in the Division of Gynecologic Oncology at the OSU Comprehensive Cancer Center. His clinical and research interests include minimally invasive surgery, treatment of recurrent disease, and improving therapy and outcomes for women with hereditary and sporadic ovarian cancer. And to hear these guys talk, they do a lot more than what I just said. They bounce all over the place. So I appreciate you being with us today to talk about this. I read that mammograms are far more accurate in women over the age of 50. I've heard that before. Why is that, Dr. Farr?
Well, there's nothing magic about 50, but 50 is when most women go through menopause. And once you go through menopause and don't have the estrogen swings, your breasts tend to become a little bit less dense. And when they become less dense, it's easier to see abnormalities.
Okay. It's just a – now, in November, Dispatch reporter Misty Crane reported about the Pap test, and that the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists had new advice about that. And we talked about that earlier, that we don't need them until we're 21. And even then, most don't need them every year. And Dr. Eisenhower, in that story, doctors told Misty that they don't worry as much about foregoing annual Pap tests. Why is that? That wasn't as controversial.
Yeah, well, we have a long history of using the Pap test. And have used it effectively in our screening for cervical cancer with a resultant decrease in the rate of cervical cancer. But we have enough experience with outcomes now for screening for cervical cancer to realize that there are consequences to the screening and that the changing the interval of Pap screening won't significantly affect the number of cancers that are missed. And so I think that the reason that the guidelines now have changed are a result of information that's been a long time coming in analyzing those outcomes to try to decrease the morbidity associated with testing too frequently while preserving the effectiveness of the screening test in terms of keeping the rate of cancers that are missed low.
What's the risk of testing?
As we've talked about with mammography, with any screening test, you pick up lesions which may be suggestive of cancer, may not have ultimately lead to a cancer. In the case of cervical cancer, that's HPV virus infections that cause changes in the cervix that are of varying degrees of severity, but some are severe enough that we worry will progress to a cancer.
Okay.
Those lesions, before they become cancers, we usually treat with either a procedure to excise or remove that portion of the cervix or to destroy that tissue. And the consequences of destroying that tissue can lead, especially in younger women, to issues with fertility down the road.
So if they don't have the test as often, it's less likely that they'll be dealing with that and they wouldn't even know they have the lesions.
Well, cervical precancerous lesions, which we call cervical dysplasia, are different than other types of cancers in that because of the infectious component, many women's immune system will clear the virus and the consequences of that infection. So we see a significant number of women with precancerous lesions whose immune systems will clear that lesion. And intervening before they've had a chance to clear it leads to, in this case, to a test which may not be necessary.
I wanted, Dr. Farr, just one more question about the mammography. What's the magic of a year? In other words, if I was high risk, my mom had it, my sister had it, it's, you know, worst case scenario, why wouldn't you be getting it every 3 or 4 months? I'm just wondering about the year thing.
That's a very good question, and actually a lot of patients, once they get cancer, want to know why we don't get mammograms every 6 months. And since we started doing mammograms, what we've found is that the development of interval cancers and an interval abnormality from 1 year to the next, you really can't notice that much changes in 6 months. And so clearly a six-month mammogram, just as a routine, doesn't change enough to warrant doing it in 6 months. Now, when we see something on a mammogram, as I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. that we're concerned about, we may repeat that in 6 months. But in general, changes don't occur that quickly.
Okay, we have a question for our guests, Dr. Eric Eisenhower and Dr. William Farr from the OSU Comprehensive Cancer Center. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we have an email from Barbara. She writes, if a woman had infections like mastitis when she was breastfeeding, can this lead to infected cysts later in life? Do other infections in the body end up in the breasts? Dr. Farr?
That happens very rarely. A lot of women have mastitis, but we see very few women that have chronically infected cysts that could be related to that. And there's really no evidence that an infection someplace else in the body ends up in the breast.
Okay. You can also call 614-292-8513. Stefania, you are on the line. You are a breast cancer survivor.
Yes, it's actually Stefania.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I was just puzzled when the new study came out, and there's this a lot of discussion about the agony of biopsies. And as a breast cancer survivor, I've had two mastectomies. The weighing, and I've had a number of biopsies at various times. When you weigh the risk of not living to raise your children versus a biopsy, I mean, they don't compare. And I just wanted to just say that. And also, I had a bone marrow transplant at the James 14 years ago. I am doing wonderfully, and I think that the James does a great job.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Oh, wait. Dr. Farr would like to say something. Yeah.
I'd just like to make a comment. Thank you very much for your comments. But if you notice in the recommendations from the task force, in which actually no one on the task force was a doctor, they talked about the as you mentioned, the agony of having a biopsy and the disfigurement. And again, that reflects the data back in the 80s and 90s where we used to do open biopsies. I mean, having a biopsy, as you mentioned today, is almost always done with a fine needle biopsy or a core biopsy, which can be uncomfortable, but it sure is not disfiguring.
Right, right. I think it seems to be coming out of the era. My mother had breast cancer back in the 60s, and she had, at the time, a radical mastectomy. And there was no chemo available, I don't think, at the time. But, you know, that the discussion of the disfigurement from mastectomies and that whole, you know, physical impairment just leaves me cold, because when you're comparing your life to, you know, a mastectomy, it seems to me that it reflects an older, mm-hmm. I don't know if you call it technology or whatever, but the whole mindset is kind of puzzling.
Little different attitudes about our bodies.
Yeah, exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. Mm-hmm. And the purpose.
Exactly. Thank you, Stefania.
Okay, you're welcome.
Take care.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye. Allison, you are on the air. You're a breast cancer survivor, too. Well, go ahead.
Yes, I want to talk about the recommendation for mammograms and the false negatives. I'm not sure how many people fall into that group, but I just finished treatment for breast cancer at the James last week, and I had a mammogram a year ago, the end of November last year, that came up completely clear. My mother had breast cancer 20 years ago, so I was in the high-risk group. I'm only 42. And 2 months later, I found the lump myself just in the shower. And I think I was one of those people who didn't do monthly exams because, you know, I was getting the mammogram every year and felt I was being checked fine. And then I found the lump completely out of the blue. And somewhere along the line, you know, I queried this with the doctors and said, how come it didn't show up on the mammogram? And they said, you know, just you're young and the kind of cancer I had doesn't show up on mammograms. And I think I'm that person that if I hadn't been getting the mammogram being checked, I wouldn't be here today. And so I was lucky. I checked myself. And my message to everyone is, you could be that person. You just need to be doing those checks every month. They cost nothing, and, you know, it certainly saved my life.
Allison, you were doing an official self-breast examination.
No, I wasn't.
Okay.
I was just in the shower, and I had an itch on the side of my body, scratched, and found this lump, and mm-hmm. immediately thought, you know, it's nothing, because I had a completely clear mammogram 2 months ago, went breezing off to the doctors. And unfortunately, they then found numerous patches throughout my breast that still didn't really show up very well on mammograms, but showed up through the MRI. So from now on, I will be, you know, getting yearly MRIs, and hopefully, you know, checking my remaining breast very carefully myself. But I just want to get the message out there that, you know, I think those self-checks every month really can save your life. If I'd been doing it myself, maybe I'd have found it a month or two earlier. I don't know, but, you know, luckily I found it when I did.
Okay, thank you, Allison.
Thank
Dr.
you.
Farr, did you want to remark on that?
Well, thank you very much for your comments. I think it really emphasizes a couple of points that we've made, that mammogram is not 100%, and about 20% of cancers are not found, especially what we call invasive lobular cancer, which sometimes can be very large and doesn't appear on mammogram or even ultrasound. And I think your comments about self-breast exam, again, emphasizes the need for a specific individual, and when they find something, it makes a big difference.
Dr. Eisenhower, regarding cervical cancer, I didn't know this until I started preparing for the program, but there's other ways to detect it besides the Pap test. There's through DNA and visualization, and there's also a self-test as well, isn't there? What is all that?
The screening for cervical cancer involves a few different steps, but the first step primarily traditionally was a Pap smear, and there are a few different mediums to analyze the cells that are removed with a Pap. Recently, also HPV testing has become available, and exactly when to add it to the Pap test for additional benefit is still, the specifics are still being determined. But there likely are going to be patients who it would benefit to have both tests done at the same time, and we do have some preliminary evidence about that. But the sequence by which cervical an abnormal Pap smear is evaluated involves what's called colposcopy next, where the cervix is visualized and abnormal areas are biopsied, which may or may not lead to additional testing from then. So there are several steps to the process.
Okay. And what about DNA? Is that just something that if you already know you're high risk, then you're tested for that, or
the HPV test?
That is the DNA test. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's get to some emails from a listener. If you'd like to email us, you can do so. allsides@wosu.org. From a listener, please comment on a recent study finding that postmenopausal women who drink moderately, 3 to 4 drinks a week, are more likely to have breast cancer recurrence than women who drink little or no alcohol. Dr. Farr, you know anything about that?
Well, there are many studies that come out, they're really small retrospective studies that come out almost monthly. And I really wouldn't put much emphasis on this study. There are other studies that show having 2 to 3 glasses of wine a week decrease your risk of having a heart attack, which is something that we got to keep in mind, that more women die of heart disease than breast cancer. And so there is no strong evidence that you can conclude that alcohol has a definite impact on breast cancer.
It is easy, particularly if you have a disease, to get read up on it. And every little bit of information that comes down the pike can affect you. Do you have that, a lot of that, where people are coming to you with – I guess it's not a bad thing, though, either. We were talking about apathy earlier and people just, you know, sitting back and letting it happen to them. And then the other end of the – is that we have access. We can go on to WebMD and –
Well, I'll comment on that. I would appreciate more questions about cervical cancer screening. The main problem we have in this country with cervical cancer is not getting people to come in for screening. The new guidelines apply primarily to women who are already coming in for regular screening and changing the intervals at which low-risk women are being screened. But the bigger problem with cervical cancer screening in this country is patients who aren't getting screening, and more than 60% of the cancers that we diagnose are picked up in women who haven't had a Pap smear within 5 years of the diagnosis.
Now, insurance covers it. So to what do you attribute? Is it just that they're not – is it an insurance issue? They're not covered by insurance, or are there other ways to get it? Are there free clinics that do that?
Most of the time it's not an insurance issue, although there are issues with access. And it's primarily an issue of access to care, or realizing that changes in the cervix that can lead to cervical cancer are usually asymptomatic. Women usually feel well, It's these changes can be picked up in younger women who don't have other medical problems and don't have perhaps other reasons to be coming in to see the doctor, and generally lead fairly busy lives with lots of other responsibilities. So I think much of it is an issue of realizing that the screening is important. Even without symptoms, these lesions can be there, and by the time symptoms occur, it oftentimes is too late.
Right. Okay, let's do another email from a male listener. I had prostate cancer in 1998. Among the various treatment options, I elected to have the prostate removed. My decision was greatly influenced by the Gleason score that accompanied the biopsy that found I had cancer. This score is an estimate by the oncologist who did the biopsy about how bad the cancerous cells looked and how rapidly they might spread. Is there something analogous to the Gleason score with regard to breast cancer that provides a woman with information about how bad the cancer is and how fast it might spread? Dr. Farr?
There are actually a lot of prognostic factors that we use for breast cancer. The most significant one is if the breast cancer has spread to the lymph nodes. But besides lymph nodes, we look at size of the tumor. We look at the grade of the tumor. We look at the estrogen receptors, the progesterone receptors, the HER2 new receptors. All of these are put into the equation to decide on the best management and also to give us an idea on how the tumor is behaving and the overall prognosis of the patient.
Okay, and we have one more phone call, time for one more phone call. Amy, you're on the air, and I'm sorry to rush you, but we're running out of time. What can we do for you?
Is being scalded by hot coffee likely to produce injuries that might cause breast cancer?
Wow, I thought you were going to ask about having an ultrasound in Italy.
That's my other question. My very first.
Sorry, I don't mean to laugh.
I had two questions. That was the first one, and the other one is that my very first mammogram showed something, and then I was in Italy, and so I went to a doctor there, and they had me have ultrasounds every month for the entire year that I was there to watch this whatever mass it was.
Let's ask Dr. Farr, and Amy, thanks for your question. Dr. Farr, in 15 seconds, can you answer that one?
I'm not sure why anyone would need to do an ultrasound every month. Things just don't change that quickly. 3 to 6 months would be a reasonable option, and we do follow things that we see on a mammogram with ultrasound. Getting a burn from hot coffee should not cause any significant risk of breast cancer.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Eric Eisenhower, Dr. William Farr. I appreciate your time today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.